right, it's time for us to get started in class here tonight. We have 48 chapters to cover in about 7 classes, so we have to study at ludicrous speed. So we have to go rather fast in our studies. And so there will be things that I will just briefly mention, and maybe from time to time you might hear me say, man, I wish we had more time to look at that, but put a star there and say, hey, that's something I'll study on my own or whatever. Or you might see some bulletin articles about that. I don't know. We'll see. So we're doing Ezekiel. We finished off just kind of looking at the introduction last time. And here's the basic outline of our 48 books. So you can kind of see where we are. We're in this first judgment section. And just by way of reminder, Ezekiel is prophesying to the people who are in captivity, who have gone in the first wave of captivity, and he's prophesying there, and he's kind of bouncing around to different places. Lots of visions with Ezekiel, lots of explicit things that, and we'll see that later on, even in this first section, and even today, some very explicit imagery with God talking and dealing with sin, and just talking about the ugliness of sin. And so we see a lot of that in this. So we're looking at chapter 7. And the chapter 7, as we look at this chapter, this idea of the end is coming, the end is pronounced. So we have this idea, verse 2, an end, the end is coming on the four corners of the land. And remember that God talks to Ezekiel and basically calls him son of man throughout the whole book. Son of man, do this thing. Son of man, do this thing. Son of man, do this thing. That's something that repeats. Something else that repeats, we'll see a lot in this chapter and other chapters, is thus they will know that I am the Lord. We saw chapter 6 end with that phrase, and we saw it several times in chapter 6. We'll see it again here in chapter 7. And so these things are happening, so they will know that I am the Lord. Because what have they forgotten? The God is the Lord, right? They've forgotten these things. So he's reminding them, but he has to go to a very far thing. Now, what I want to notice, if you want to take some time and count, I didn't take the time to count, but you can do that. In verses 3 and 4, you see this word used over and over again. The end is upon you, and I will send my anger against you, and you, and your, and your, and you, and you see that over and over again. Who's accountable for these actions? They are, right? God is pointing out here, this is, you are reaping what you have sown. And what's interesting, if you also, as you read through this, circle where God says, my. He says, throughout this, in this section that we're looking at tonight, he talks about here in verse 4, my eye will have no pity. He talks about my face. He talks about my sanctuary. And so it's interesting to say, the separation language kind of imagery we have, there's you and yours over here, and there's what's mine. And there's this, we see the separation with the people. So we have the end is coming. Then we have this unique disaster. And he says in verse 5, thus says the Lord God, a disaster, a unique disaster, behold, is coming. An end is coming. And the end has come, is awakened against you. Behold, it has come. And you see this God just kind of shouting this message to them, and Ezekiel shouting this message. This doom is pronounced. In verse 8, I will shortly pour out my wrath on you and spend my anger against you and judge you according to your ways and bring on you all your abominations, verse 8. This is again, we see that repeated from verses 3 and 4. We see this kind of sandwich here of God pronouncing judgment. And verse 9 starts with, my eye will show no pity, nor will I spare. I will repay according to your ways. And so again, in verse 9, then you will know that I, the Lord, do the smiting. I'm the one that's doing this. This is what I'm doing. And so we have this unique disaster. Then a rod of wickedness, violence has grown, verse 11, into a rod of wickedness. None of them shall remain, none of their people, none of their wealth, nor anything eminent among them. So the language that we see here with Ezekiel is rather complete. And we don't see, we see this kind of this happening. Verse 12, the time has come, the day has arrived. Again, this idea that now is the time not of salvation. Now is the time where you're reaping what has been sown. And so we see that here, this rod of wickedness. and then a sword outside and the plague and famine within. This is that idea, again, remember when we talk about this idea of a siege, and the Jerusalem will be sieged and you'll die with famine and plague. There's no safety inside, there's no safety outside, there's no safe place to hide. If you happen to live, it's because I have allowed you to live, as we kind of see later on tonight in this study. God is saying, if you happen to survive this turmoil, it's because I allowed you to survive. And so there is no place, no safe place. Verses 19 through 14 through 19. Verse 17, all hands will hang limp, all knees will become like water. It's interesting to look at that idea when God is pronouncing judgment. And then fast forward over into Hebrews chapter 12. In Hebrews chapter 12, the imagery is used, strengthen up your feeble knees, your hands that are limp. God's given you reason to have strength. Here, he's taken that away. But in the future, there'll be time when that's different. Again, we don't have time to dive into all that. Verse 19, their silver and their gold will not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. There's nothing that they held precious will deliver them. Their silver and their gold, their golden idols that they had prayed to and bowed, will not save them. The money that maybe they had trusted in will not save them. They're not going to buy their way out from captivity. None of those things, none of their wealth will be able to save them. And so this is not a situation any of us would want to be in. And then we see the temple being profaned. And he said, they transformed the beauty of his ornaments into pride. Tie that in with down in verse 24. I will also make the pride of the strong ones cease and their holy places to be profaned. He uses that idea of pride in relationship to, we'll see in next chapter, in relationship to their idols. The pride of them were their idols. Look at our idols. Look at what we have made. Look at what we have fashioned with our own hands. Look at what we have done. This became their pride. Not God, not his holiness, not who he was no longer their pride. It was their idols. Of course, we have ceased from that today, right? We have no pride in anything that we have made or fashioned with our own hands. It's one thing to have pride in craftsmanship and be able to make something, but it's another thing to have pride and trust in something other than God, right? That's a completely different thing. And so that's what we see here. And he says in verse 22, again, my face, I will also turn my face from them. And so he said, they have entered into my secret place and robbers will enter in. There's nothing's going to be saved. All their holy places will be profaned, just like they've profaned his. And then verse 25, when anguish comes, they will seek peace, but there will be none. So here's the God of all comfort saying, because you have done this thing, when you seek peace, there will be no peace. This is not a pronouncement we would want to be receiving from God, is it? Or anybody would want to be receiving from God. Verse 27, everybody's going to mourn. The king will mourn, the prince will be clothed with horror in the hands of the people, and the land will tremble. End of verse 27, what does he say? End of verse 27. Why is he doing this? And they will know. Slightly repetitive, right? But he's dealing with a hard-headed people. And he says, and they will know that I am the Lord, that I am the Lord, as we finish that up in chapter 7. So we see this end pronounced in chapter 7. And so we see this happening. Now, chapter 8 opens up with another date stamp. It came about in the sixth year on the fifth day of the sixth month. And again, this is a correlation with the exile of the king. And so this is about September 17th of the year 592. If you want to, you know, put that out there, we can get pretty close with the date on these things because of not only the information we have in the Bible, but other sources allow us to date these things pretty close. So September 17th, 592, we don't know what time of day necessarily, but he said he was sitting in the house with his elders, with the elders of Judah, and we had this other vision. Now chapter 8, the vision is tied very closely with the temple. Chapter 8 through 11 essentially, the visions are tied closely with areas in the temple. So I wanted this picture to be up there so we could remind ourselves of how Solomon's temple was laid out. We can kind of see in our mind's eye these things going from place to place around the temple. What we're also going to see in chapter 8, as he is kind of transported in this vision, he says, and then I looked and behold the likeness of the appearance of a man. And we see in verses the glory of God, verses 1 through 4. That same image that we saw in chapter 1, with the cherubim and the expanse above the cherubim where God was, and the wheels within the wheels, not aliens, the wheels within the wheels, is all there to show the glory of God. Where else do we see visions of grandeur like this for man to be in a sense of awe of who God was? Do we see this any other place in the Bible? Revelation, right? Revelation plays out the throne room scene for us. And so that's a very similar thing that we see this repeated again. This is not to give us sort of, I've got to figure out what those wheels are. It's not about that. What this is about is the glory of God. What this is about is man saying, thinking that they knew something, and man bowing down before God and God saying, here I am in my glory and my splendor. Have awe of who I am. That's what this is about in this scene. And so that's what Ezekiel does. And he says in verse 4, like the appearance which I saw in the plain. This is what I saw earlier. I'm seeing it again. And so verse 5, we see this idol of jealousy. And he said to me, son of man, raise your eyes toward the north. So I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, the north of the altar. So we see that north gate there above the bronze altar, the little square in the middle there is a bronze altar. He's looking towards that north gate. And he says, the idol of jealousy at the entrance. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 30, chapter 32, verse 34, talks about how they had put the idols in the temple. And so he's referencing one of those idols in the temple. He's saying, this idol is what he's saying. He said to me, son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations that he's saying, he said, I will be far from my sanctuary. And this phrase repeats here. He says, but yet you will see still greater abominations. And so we see this image, this idol of jealousy. And at the end of that, he says, but you will see greater abominations. And then we see this next kind of scene, sin in the dark. And so he said, he brought me to the entrance of the court. And so the entrance to the court there in the middle, to the right there of the bronze altar, there at the entrance of the court, and he sees there's a hole in the wall. And what does he ask him to do with the hole in the wall? What does God ask Ezekiel to do with the hole in the wall? To dig it out. And what does he find in there? He finds an entrance. All of a sudden, we're in the Temple of Doom, right? So he goes into this place. And what does he find down in there? He says he goes in and see the wicked abominations that are committing there. And he looked, and behold, for every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things, with all the idols in the house of Israel carved in the wall and surrounding. Standing in front of them are the 70 elders of the house of Israel, with Jezaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them, each man with his censer in his hand and the fragrance of the cloud of incense rising. Now, he names names in this chapter. Names are names, all right? It's like a preacher calling names on Sunday, right? This is what's happening here. Whether or not these are actual people, we don't know. It's possible they were. It's possible these were prominent elders that he's calling out. It's possible that these are figurative of representative or just popular names of the time and meant to represent a large swath of people. We don't know exactly. But he names names. What are they doing in this dark place? They're worshiping idols, all the creeping and detestable things. I just think when going down into this dark place, I just feel dirty reading this. Do you get that sense? This is not a clean place. This is not a holy place. This is everything but holy, right? And we see that. I don't know if you've watched Indiana Jones movies where all the bugs are falling from the ceiling and that kind of stuff. That's what I imagine happening here in this scene. And God is saying, look at this detestable thing they're doing in my holy place. And they say in this section of verse 12, the Lord does not see us, the Lord has forsaken this land. He doesn't see what I'm doing in this dark place. And of course, we don't do that. Nobody does that anymore. Yet you will see still greater abominations which they are committing. And we transition into another scene. And so this is very short. The Tammuz, and he said, brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which is toward the north, and behold, women are sitting and weeping for Tammuz. And he said to me, Do you see this, son of man? And he said, you will see greater abominations. This apparently was a god of that area, and part of part of this particular God was destruction and rebirth. And so at the destruction, you know, as the change of seasons was the destruction of this God, and they would weep. And then in spring and the renewal of this God, they would, of course, do everything but weep, right? That's, you can imagine the detestable things they would do in spring. That's a lot of religions have that kind of pantheistic idea. And so that's what this possibly being done here in this place. And so he mentions this, and we see this happening. And then we have worship of the sun possibly being talked about here in verse 16 and 16 through 18. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. And so the inner court right now, we're looking at this area that's kind of, as we go into the holy place, between the two bronze pillars, you see those dots represented there with the bronze pillars. We're standing on that step and we're looking back towards the square, the bronze altar. That's where we are in verses 16 through 18. And what is portrayed there? What's happening? What's the story? What's the scene that's being portrayed there? How many men are standing there? 25, right? And so their backs are to the temple, and their faces toward the bronze. Some have said that possibly this is like a representative of the king, and then one or two of every tribe of Israel. We don't know, but 25 are there, right? And what does God say in verse 17? Would somebody read verse 17 for us? All right, so we see this being... And we can kind of see, like, do you see what they're doing? This indignation that's happening here and what they're doing, what they're committing before them. And his response then in verse 18, therefore, indeed, I indeed will deal in wrath. My eye will have no pity, nor will I spare. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not listen to them. Again, circle my eyes, my ears will have nothing to do with them. And so he says, we finish this scene here in chapter 8, there on the steps there of the temple. Now the next chapter, chapter 9, is rather bleak. It is not anything, and it's something that's almost out of a horror movie, as we see in chapter 9. And so we have in verses 1 and 2, the executioners are called. He says, then he cried out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen with the writing case at his loins. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. So they're coming from that north gate and they're walking down towards that bronze altar. And I do not imagine that these executioners are nice-looking young men, right? They're coming in with their destroying weapons. We have no idea what that is. I have my ideas with what they are, but it's because I've seen a lot of horror movies, okay? So they have their destroying weapons that they're coming in and standing beside the bronze altar. And you have one with a writing instrument, one clothed in linen. And so they're standing there. Then the glory of the God, Israel, went up from the cherub. And so, we see the glory of God moving from place to place, always above the cherub, never touching any of these things, always kind of using the cherubs as a buffer of His holiness, of His purity, kind of a buffer between all these things that are taking place. And He goes up into the threshold of the temple, and He called to the man clothed in linen at whose loins was a writing case. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. Why is that significant? Why is that significant? Saving the ones that are following him. Yes, sir. Does God know those who are His?
Yes.
Yes, He does. Right? Even when we looked at the end of the book of Malachi, we had that message. Those who were speaking against, God listened, His ear turned to them. We see here God marking those who are His. The same kind of imagery is used even in the book of Revelation, talking about those who are His, marked those who are His. So we see that imagery here again. Then we have this contrast, but... to the others, he said, in my hearing, go through the city after him and strike and do not let your eye have pity and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women, and do not touch any man on whom is the mark. But you shall start from my sanctuary. So they started with the elders who were before the temple. And they went out. That is a rather somber reminder of the seriousness of sin. And that's our takeaway from at least chapter 9, from this whole book. But from chapter 9 is the seriousness of sin. Sin does not spare. Sin contaminates. And we have to do everything we can to stop that from contaminating those that we love around us. That's a somber lesson. I'm sorry that I didn't write it, Ezekiel did. God had it written, but it's a somber lesson as God begins this judgment that's upon them. In verse 8, as they are striking the people, I alone was left. Imagine the imagery that's here, and imagine being Ezekiel the one seeing this. God showing this to Ezekiel, I imagine, and this is just me, but I imagine that if I was Ezekiel and I was seeing these things taking place, that I would be all the more boldened to speak on behalf of God to make sure this didn't happen again. Because he's not done. We're in chapter 9 of 48 chapters. He's not done delivering God's message. And I would hope that he would be more boldened to continue doing that. But he says, alas, Lord God, are you destroying the whole remnant of Israel by pouring out your wrath on Jerusalem? And so he begins, God, we have the execution, then we have the sin of Israel, and God is saying, this is a sin. This is, he says in verse 9, the Lord has forsaken the land, and the Lord does not see. And this is important. So this is what they're saying. They're saying the Lord has forsaken. They're saying God doesn't even know what's going on. And he says, but as for me, my eye will have no pity. I will bring their conduct upon their heads. They're the issue. He says the sin of Judah is very, very great. Yes, so he's not destroying, So Ezekiel saw him actually putting marks on people, hopefully. So there were those that were saved, and so he's saying, are you going to destroy everybody? Maybe it's just the disparity between the very few marks there were and just the totality of the destruction of everybody else, that in that disparity he cries out, not literally he's going to destroy everybody, but it feels like he's destroying everybody because maybe there's just so few of those that are marked. What's interesting in verse 11, the man clothed in linen comes back and says, I've done just as you have commanded me. We see that happen, and that is taking place. But it's interesting, the fault is not laid at God's feet. The fault is laid at the feet of the sinners. It is their iniquity. I will bring their conduct upon their heads. This is what they sowed. And so we see this dark image in chapter 9 with the sins of Israel. And then we're not done with the temple. In chapter 10, we see this coals of fire. The one clothed in white linen is asked to take coals. he spoke to the man clothed, verse 2, enter between the whirling wheels under the cherubim and fill your hands with coals of fire from between the cherubim and scatter them over the city. Well, we're done with coals that we saw maybe in Isaiah. What was done? Why would he use coals? Why are we thinking to scatter coals all over the city? To burn it? Yeah. To burn fire is seen as a purification element, isn't it? We see fire that purifies faith, that burns off dross. We see fire that burns away the chaff and burns away those things that won't stand. And with Isaiah, when he says, behold, I'm an unclean man, I dwell among people of unclean lips, and he uses the coal to kind of cleanse that and say, well, I'll burn that off of you. It's possible that these coals, once the judgment's passed, I'm cleansing it. I'm going to scatter the coals across, coals from a holy place, and we're going to cleanse this. It's possible that's what's being done here. And so that is what's taking place. And then there's a lot going on about the cherubim and going in and grabbing these coals. And the cherubim stretched out his hand in verse 7. And so we see that take place. And then verse 9 through 14, there's this description of the whirling wheels. What are these things? We don't know. They're called whirling wheels. That is all we know about them. And what you can divine from the description in the text is as much as we know about them. If you want to go online and Google pictures of these things, there are 100 different ways people draw these things. Some with spacesuits, some without spacesuits, all right? But there are 100 different ways that people draw these whirling wheels. Again, we can't get lost on the whirling wheels. That is, the whirling wheels aren't the focus here. The whirling wheels are part of the grandeur of who God is in that moment. So we see them, they move around with the cherubim, and that's all we got, ladies and gentlemen. That's all we have. Unless the Bible says otherwise, that's what we have. Then we have, again, the description of the living beings. They're described again. Verse 15, he says, they are the living beings that I saw by the river, River Chebar. And he kind of goes into talking about them again. So he begins just giving us more information about them. But verse 18, then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. So again, this idea of being close proximity to the cherubim, the glory of God, that glory, that Shekinah glory, that and the presence of God on earth. And so we see that here at the end of chapter 10. Chapter 11, we have the men who devise iniquity. As we see here, opening up verses 1 through 4, and again, naming names. He says, and behold, there were 25 men at the entrance of the gate. Among them I saw Jezaniah, son of Asher, and Pelathiah, son of Benaiah, leaders of the people. So these were those who were the faced eastward. Again, going to that kind of gate there in the middle, facing eastward. And so these are the men who devise iniquity and grieve and give evil advice to the city. These are the ones that say the time is not near to build houses. Because Jeremiah chapter 29, if you want to write out to the side of here, Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 4 and 5. Jeremiah, when he was pronouncing judgment from God, he said, you're going to go over into captivity and you're going to build houses and plant gardens when you're in captivity. What does that mean? Why would I be building houses and planting gardens? How long am I going to stay there if I'm building a house? You're going to be there a while, right? According to investors, if you're going to stay in a place for longer than 5 years, you can buy a house. If you're not staying there longer than 5 years, you don't want to take time to invest in buying a house. You rent, right? So, obviously, they're spending time there for a while. They're buying a house, they're planting gardens, they're doing things that you would do if you're going to be there for a long time. And these people are saying, no. It's not time to build a house. What is he saying? The city is a pot and we are the flesh. The idea that they're inside this cauldron protected from the flame. There's nothing that's going to get in here and get us, right? Of course, we know otherwise. And he says, verse 4, therefore prophesy against them, son of man, prophesy. And so God's calling the thunder against these people who are dealing falsely with his message. And so we see this again, the Spirit of the Lord falls on him. And he says, thus says the Lord, which he says every time he speaks on behalf of God, so you think, house of Israel, for I know your thoughts. That should be a scary thing, right? I know your thoughts. I know what's going on. You have multiplied your slain in the city, filling its streets with them. The reason they've multiplied the slain in the city is because they thought, oh, yeah, there's nothing going on. They cried peace, peace, when there was no peace, which is what Jeremiah had against them at the same time. There was no peace. There was going to be no peace. And they cried and they lied to them about what's going on. Your slain whom you have laid in the midst of the city are flesh, and the city is a pot, but I will bring you out of it. You have feared the sword, so I will continue. I'll bring the sword on you, verse 8. In verse 10, here it is again, so you shall know that I am the Lord. Verse 12, thus you will know that I am the Lord, for you have not walked in my statutes, nor have you executed my ordinances, but have acted according to the ordinance of the nations around you. And then verse 13, he calls somebody out again. The same guy that he said earlier, Pelathiah, son of Benaiah, died. He just dropped dead. And again, the last God, will you bring the remnant of Israel to a complete end? And so we see compassion, we see hurt on behalf of Ezekiel seeing these things. But God is saying they are the ones that brought this upon themselves. That's the message. But with any prophet, and with any message of God, especially, you know, we have these short respites here. There is a future restoration. God with his prophets, except for a very few, there's always this idea of future restoration. This will not last forever. There will be a time when things will come back. And we for lack of time, he basically says, I will be their sanctuary in captivity. They go into captivity, and I will be their sanctuary in captivity. Watching, I'm taking care of them by sending them into captivity, is this idea here. Verse 19 is very important. He says, "And I will give them one heart and put a new spirit within them. And I will take their heart of stone out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh. And they will walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them. And they will be my people and I will be their God." If you want to write out beside there, Jeremiah chapter 31, 31 through 34, the same similar idea is being stated there in Jeremiah. Also write out there Hebrews chapter 8, verses 8 through 12, where that is verbatim stated in Hebrews chapter 8, verses 8 through 12. So Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34, and Hebrews 8, 8 through 12, this idea of future restoration. "But those whose hearts go after detestable things, I will bring their conduct on their own heads." And so there's always that back and forth. Then this is interesting. "Then the cherubim lifted up their wings and the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel hovered over them. And the glory of the Lord went up in the midst of the city and stood over the mountain which is east of the city." What is that mountain east of the city, the mountain most close to the Temple Mount? Mount Zion, Mount of Olives. And it's from that place that the glory of God ascends back up and the vision ends. That's where God kind of rests at this point. That's interesting. So he was in the temple and has gone to these different stations, then goes there to the Mount of Olives. Yes, ma'am. That's a very good question. So there's a couple things going on here. You have those that are marked and those that are destroyed in chapter 9. Then you again chapter 10 and 9, and then you have chapter 11 where you have these. All of a sudden, there's more people that are doing detestable things, and so it's like a vision, and then inside of a vision of different time maybe. But those in chapter 11 that he mentions that are doing his will, those are the ones either yes that are marked. That are saved from the siege, that survive the siege, and then those who are taken and eventually taken into captivity. So if you read the text here, beginning of verse 14, God protects those who are His by actually sending them into captivity. And He said, "I will be a sanctuary for you while you're in captivity." So basically God is saying, if you survive, it's because I wanted you to survive this. Does that answer your question with... Yes, we're going from like image. There is some sort of disconnect because we have like everybody killed in one, and you go to the next one, but there's still these detestable guys over here, and so we're going from image to image. The one image doesn't necessarily bleed over into the other one. Maybe the only connection we have from image to image is that God is still moving from place to place and showing him these different scenes. And also with Hebrew imagery and stuff, and even their history, their history and the way they do things is not linear. Like when we think of something happening, it's very linear. One thing happens after the next. But what they do with their history and things is they'll go up to a certain point, then they'll go back and start over again with here. And so that may be what's happening here with these detestable people on the step. He's going back to them. But eventually they will be destroyed as well. So that's where there's some disconnect there between. But that's a very good question in keeping things kind of on pace. So we see this remnant, and in the end of chapter 11, he says, "Then I told the exiles all the things." Chapter 11 ends, and he told them what he saw. He talked to the exiles about these things. The vision ends. Chapter 12, we start just a new section in chapter 12. All these oracles about the Israel and Jerusalem, and we have this symbol that's being used. And he talks about the sign of the exile. And he says, "Hey, you need to pack up like you're going to exile, and they need to see you going into exile, and they need to see you digging through the wall and trying to get out in exile, and they need to see you doing these things because that's what they're going to do when they're finally sieged in Jerusalem." And he says that's what's going to happen. In verse 6 is very, very important. He says you should do it in their sight, do it in their sight, do it in their sight, verses 4, 5, and 6. And he says, "For I have set you as a sign to the house of Israel." Ezekiel, when he takes on this burden, as was translated in other versions, when he takes on this burden, he becomes a sign to the people. His life is completely surrendered to whatever God asks him to do, and his life is a sign to Israel. Every aspect, even the death of his wife in the future, becomes a sign to the people. Is there some imagery or some similarities between what when God asked his prophet to do these things, could we be assigned to people today? When God asks you to do things, I don't care how weird it is, I don't care how contrary to popular belief it is, I've asked you to do these things because you are my sign to this people. Jesus doesn't use the word sign necessarily. He uses salt. He uses light. He uses that kind of influence. But here he says, you are my sign to these people. And if Ezekiel did anything else than what he was asked to do, he would not be the correct sign that he's asked to do. And so we see that here. And so we see the siege of the sign of desolation. They have to go and they eat their food real fast and nervous because they don't have a lot of it and just the uncertainty of the times there. Again, I realize we're going very quickly through this. And then we have these proverbs that are being stated. The days are long and every vision fails, is what's said in verse 22. These are what the people are saying. He said that God's visions aren't happening, that nothing takes place. And they say down in verse 25, he says, "For I, the Lord, will speak, and whatever the word I speak will be performed. It will no longer be delayed, for in your days, O rebellious house, I will speak the word and perform it, declares the Lord." And so they begin saying that nothing happens. The day draws near and every vision is fulfilled. Nothing is even happening that God is saying. Verse 27, the vision that he sees is for many years from now and his prophecies are for times afar off. And God is saying, no, they're happening now. In your day, you will see these things completed. We've seen that with Isaiah and other prophecies that take place way in the future. And so they're kind of resting on that idea. Well, it's not even going to, in my day, that's not even going to happen. I can do whatever I want. God's not here anymore. We're never going to see that take place. But the message is, no, it's happening now, and you will see it. And so that's what's, none of my words will be delayed any longer, verse 28. So we see these proverbs, and God's turning them on their heads. Thank you very much for your patience as we literally just ran as fast as we could through those chapters. I would encourage you to go back and read some of these and digest some of them and take your time looking over them. Thank you very much for tonight.